Hello and welcome to Think Rant. I'm John Stabler.
And I'm Steve Brett.
And this is the...
And I have a terrible case of déjà vu.
This must be the eighth time we've done the intro to this. And you're having it raw. Very raw. We tried to go live. We had issues with that. And it's just not working, Steve, is it?
No. So, no, that's not to put too fine a point on it.
Yeah, so we're knocking it on the head. And we're just going to give you the podcast, but with a lot less pressure on us now, maybe we can perform to our usual high standards.
I was ready to perform to my usual high standards anyway, John.
Yeah, yeah. I put a lot of pressure on myself, so we'll sort that out. Okay, what I wanted to say was that, forget the live stuff for now, but you can get hold of us using Facebook. Do a search for Think Rant Podcast and a community will appear.
Yep, you can get in touch with us via Twitter, at ThinkRant.
And you can also go to the blog, which is stabler.tv. I've been quite active on there lately. I don't know if you noticed that, Steve?
I have noticed that, and even I've made a post on the blog in the last week.
Yeah, so, shock.
Certainly is.
Tonight's podcast is also going to be a little shorter than usual. One, because we wasted so much time with technical difficulties. And two, we've had feedback saying that we... blabber on too much.
I can't believe that for a minute.
I can't believe that either. So without any further ado, we will move on with the podcast. So this week, Steve, how about you take the lead, okay? Give me a story, something that I can either think about or rant about.
Well, here we are. I mean, you know, we were planning to be live, so I've actually prepared some stories for this week. I've got some here in front of me to take a look at. I just think, you know, because you're a bit of a difficult start to the evening so far, I'll start off with a lighter note, I think.
Okay.
And this is something which I'm quite happy about, to be honest with you. But only pasties now made in Cornwall can be called Cornish pasties. Now how do you feel about that, John?
Well, I actually already thought that was the case because quite a while ago they'd already stopped Champagne, you know, it had to come from the Champagne region, and
well,
I thought it was similar.
Yeah, absolutely. It's called a PGI, which means Protected Geographical Indication.
Right.
And it's something which the EU status awards to things like champagne, like Caffili cheese,
Cumberland sausage.
I'm not sure about that. Possibly, but I'm not 100% sure. And now pasties, Cornish pasties, are protected by the same legislation, and that makes me quite happy, to be honest with you, because, you know, there's nothing quite like a Cornish pasty, and you know, there's many cheap imitations, so, you know, let's have the real thing, let's have it, and I'm really happy to see, to be honest with you.
Okay, so I mean, how do you think that's going to affect you? I mean, do you feel wrong somehow that you've picked up a Cornish pasty previously and it's
not Cornish?
Yeah.
No, to be honest, I don't. The reason why I'm really happy for this is because, as ridiculous as it sounds, a pasty is part of the Cornish identity. You know, there's instances of pasties going right back to the 1300s in Cornwall. People who emigrated to America with the Pilgrim Fathers, you know, they took pasties with them to America, and there's like pasty fairs and that in America now, in certain states. And, you know, I just think This is an important thing for Cornish identity, for Cornish trade, for Cornish people. The Cornish people are very proud people, very similar to the Welsh. You know, they consider themselves a nation separate to England, even though they are geographically part of that country at the moment. And so, I'm really happy for them. Like I say, that Cornish pasties are only Cornish. It also means as well that, you know, I would only get a real Cornish pasty when I have one, which means that you don't get any of this crimped nonsense on top. You get a nice folded crust on the side, which you can grab hold of and sink your teeth into succulent meat and potato and a little bit of sweet. It's good times.
Yeah, you obviously take your pasties far more seriously than I do.
I love my pasties.
Okay. I would never, ever have guessed that, Steve. I'm not going to say anything cruel. I'm going to continue with the light. I'm going to continue with the light-hearted stories. Okay, this one, you know, this isn't even our usual thing, but I just got to do it because when I read it, it made me laugh so hard. I thought this story might actually be made up. Okay, right. Listen to this. Brazilian woman finds alligator behind sofa.
I saw the headline first. I never read the story, so enlighten me.
Right. So a woman in Brazil was shocked to find an alligator hiding behind her sofa after heavy rains flooded her house in the town of, I can't even pronounce that, in Paris State. Okay. So
I'd be quite surprised if I found an alligator behind my settee.
So I was like, going, that makes sense. There was floods, so the alligator came in with the water. Okay. But this bit really tickled me. Well, it doesn't. I mean, just listen. She said she was alerted to the reptile's presence by her 3-year-old son, who was patting its head.
That's terrible. That's terrifying.
So you walk in, you know, with your plate of biscuits and tea, or whatever they do in Brazil, and your kid's there. Mummy, can we keep it? Patting the alligator on the head.
Oh, my word.
So luckily, she managed to snatch her child away. This alligator was 1.5 metres long. It's a 5-footer.
It's quite a beast, then.
So
a 3-year-old posed no problems.
Yeah. They called in the firefighters.
As you do.
I suppose, you know, like in this country, firefighters get cats down from trees. Yeah. In Brazil, they
get alligators from behind couches.
Yeah. So they turned up and they said the family was lucky that the reptile's not hungry.
I should say they were.
So, yeah, I mean, can you believe that? But the bit that made me laugh was the last sentence. It was the firefighter captain who was quoted in this saying, you know, just as well it wasn't hungry and it's not uncommon for these alligators, said he said the reptile had been released in a less populated area of the town.
Why would it release it in the town?
Why not release it in the wild? Not, you know, what happened? They were driving down the road and they were like,
this looks like a good place for Billy Alligator. Let's jump him out here.
You know, there's not so many people around here, so we'll just dump it out here. You know, what if it found its way back? You know, what if it was like a, I don't know, maybe
what, a homing alligator.
Like a homing. So, you know, that tickled me, that story. So I just thought I'd mention.
Yeah, I mean, it's amusing, but it's also horrifying, isn't it? I mean, I couldn't imagine that, walking in and finding my child patting the head of a vicious killer.
Yeah. Maybe they're not. I mean, maybe they just have a bad rep, these alligators.
No, they're vicious killers.
Go on then, give us a story before we... Because I still think that we're going to move on to the main story.
Okay, I've got one here for you. Again, it's just to get your thoughts on it.
Okay.
I think we'll probably share the same opinion, so it's quite a quick one, I think, really. There is on the BBC News today a story about a gentleman called Andre Pejic, an Australian man. Why is he in the news? Because he is a fashion model, but he displays women's clothes. So we have a male model wearing women's clothes on the catwalk, which is causing a bit of a storm, really.
Where is it causing a storm?
Well, just in the around the fashion world, and you know, this is he's a very sought after guy, because apparently, I'm looking at a picture of him here now, he has quite feminine features, and it lends himself, and he's 6 foot tall, and it lends himself to showing off the couture fashion to its best, really, to be honest with you. So he's emerging as an it face, in inverted commas.
Well, you know, I don't have a problem with it. I couldn't possibly. But strange that the fashion industry would have some problems with it, considering the industry's... I thought it was more tolerant of people with different sexuality. Is transsexual somehow, or trans?
But,
sorry, not transsexual.
I don't think it's just the fashion industry. I think, you know, the public's response to it is a bit as well. Do you know what I mean? Because transgender issues are still kind of swept under the carpet a little bit, as opposed to homosexuality, lesbianism, which are now becoming more and more. I don't like to use the word tolerated, because that's not necessarily the right word. But they're more accepted. People are more understanding, and people realise that, you know, actually, being gay doesn't make you a freak. But there's still a little bit of that thought towards transgendered people. Where, you know, you see a guy walking down the road in women's dress, and you think, oh my God, there goes a freak. And, you know, I think this is great that there is somebody out there who is so high profile and doing such a job in the fashion industry. I think it is really, really good for transgendered people. I think it's going to help them quite a lot.
Yeah.
And hopefully, you know, society will become more understanding and accepting.
No, definitely. And maybe, you know, I mean, if a bloke walks down the street in women's clothes, you know, I'm not going to lie, it's probably going to get my attention. But only because I see it so rarely.
Precisely. You know? Precisely. And that's why I think, you know, this sort of high-profile person is brilliant for the transgender community.
No, good stuff. Time for a short break to the usual proceedings. We now bring to you this week's special guest interview. So he's founder of the Leeds Atheist Society and Leeds Skeptics, as well as the co-founder of the Humanist Action Group and co-founder and former trustee of the National Federation of Atheist, Humanist and Secular Student Societies, and chair of the Chris Warfolk Foundation. Chris Warfolk, hello.
Good evening.
I wanted to talk to you about the Inquiry 2011 conference in Edinburgh. Can you tell us what it's about, who's organising it and who it's aimed at?
So it's a two-day conference on science, scepticism and humanism that's being arranged by my charity. We ran the same conference last year. We ran the conference in Birmingham last year, and as nice as a city as Birmingham is, we really wanted somewhere that was a bit more aesthetically pleasing. And the other great thing about running it in Edinburgh in April is that it's right in the middle of the science festival. So anyone heading up for the science festival can also drop by Inquiry, and obviously they're a very similar target audience, so we're hoping that you can get two for one, as it were.
Great. And how many people are you expecting, both to the science festival and how many are you hoping to have at the conference?
We're keeping the conference fairly small, so it'll be between 100 150 people. I think that's probably a good number, between being able to get good and interesting speakers in and still being able to kind of say hi to everyone that's attending and get a really nice social atmosphere going.
Now, the speakers themselves, what's the lineup at the moment?
So we've got Richard Wiseman, Paul Braterman, who is on the British Centre for Science Education, which is an anti-creationist group. And then we've also got the comedian Robin Innes, John Ronson, Dr. Heisbert Stute, who is head of the Humanist Chaplaincy Network, and quite a lot of other speakers, which you can check out on the website. But on top of the speakers, it's also more of a social conference as well. So as opposed to a lot of conferences, one of the things we're doing is actually going away from the conference venue and doing things like guided tours of the city of Edinburgh. And we also have entertainment on the Saturday night. We've got Carmen DeCruz coming up to provide some live music. And we've also got Magic on as well.
Oh, that's great. Have you got a favourite speaker, someone that you're looking forward to hearing?
I'm really looking forward to Paul Braterman, I think, because we had one of the other members of the British Centre for Science Education at Leeds Skeptics a few weeks ago, and he was fantastic. So I'm really looking forward to that. And I'm a big Robin Innes fan as well.
There's been a noticeable increase in the number of these science and scepticism conferences, such as TAM, ThinkCon, and now Inquiry 2011. Why do you think that is?
I think people are waking up to the fact that there's such an appetite in the general public for this. I mean, when TAM first came to London, it just took us all by storm, I think. I think it sold out in maybe half an hour, was it? TAM's not even a cheap conference. So I think since then, and especially with the rise in the Skeptics in the Pub movement, the amount of new groups that seem to be popping up, and groups that are becoming increasingly popular and getting increasingly good speakers, has been really impressive. And I think that's created a real demand for these kind of conferences.
I mean, only last week we had Simon Singh in Cardiff. How important do you think it is to have these names giving their time to the sceptical movement?
Oh, well, I think it's the backbone of getting people into scepticism and into thinking critically. I mean, if you can get a celebrity to come along and get people who wouldn't normally come to a sceptics meeting or necessarily think critically and kind of be exposed to that, then I think that can only be a really positive thing for both the movement and society in general.
Just out of interest, I wanted to talk about your foundation, but before we did, would you like to talk about your own journey into scepticism?
So I really came in from the atheist angle. having founded Leeds Atheist Society while I was a student. I really did that because there were big religious societies on campus, and I guess I wanted to put a bit more of a balance into it. And I think the same thing with skepticism. I mean, you see a lot of woo pushed across society these days, and that was really something I wanted to get involved with and present the other side, I guess it would be.
And how does your skepticism and your atheism fit in with the foundation?
So one thing I kind of noticed with a lot of the kind of atheist skeptic movement, particularly in the humanist movement, was there was a lot of people talking about how we could be good without God, but not necessarily doing it. So the idea behind the Chris Warford Foundation is really to bring the kind of the social action side where, you know, we believe that there is no God and that humans are therefore, you know, should be our kind of main focus and this is the only life we have. So we should really go out there and actually make the most of it for not just ourselves, but the people around us as well.
Well, thanks very much, Chris. It was great talking to you.
Thanks.
The Inquiry Conference 2011 is a conference on scepticism, science and humanism, right in the heart of the Edinburgh Science Festival on April 16th to the 17th. For more information, go to the website at inquiryconference.org. Right, I don't know how long this is going to go on for.
Okay.
But we'll see. I sent you a link to a YouTube video.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this was of particular interest to me because of the amount of debate it generated. It was phenomenal, okay? So what I'm going to do is I'm just going to explain what the video depicts, just for so everybody knows who haven't seen it. I will be putting up a link to it on the blog to go with this episode.
Yeah, interactive blog, well done.
Yeah, so people can go. I mean, we should have been doing it anyway. We should link to all of the stories we talk about. But I'll definitely be putting up a link to this so people can go and check it out. Basically, a gentleman named Mike, who calls himself the religious antagonist. And as you'll find out, I think he lives up to that name.
I think you're right.
In his latest episode, Mike approaches a homeless man and offers him $20 to scratch the word God off the sign he is holding. The man refuses. Mike questions the man's rationality. Why is he refusing real money for a fairy tale? The man's wife gets involved and also refuses. Mike engages them both, and supposed hilarity ensues as Mike tries to get the couple to give up their faith in a higher power for the temptation of $20. Now, I'm reading this off SkepChick,
mm-hmm.
which was actually the one that brought it to everyone's attention. Well, it certainly brought it to my attention. Now, on SkepChick, which is... it's basically a blog for women skeptics. I don't know if you've...
I've never heard of it.
No, fine. I have, because I go there quite often. The overall opinion on this was very... They were very, very annoyed by it. They thought it was pretty shocking.
Okay.
They thought... Basically, he was just taking advantage of homeless people. And... The reaction was pretty bad. I think there was some people who didn't think it was so bad. And then I went to some other blogs that were also talking about it. And the opinion varied depending what area we were in. But it was very interesting to see, you know, non-believers split over this kind of issue.
Yeah.
So what were your thoughts on it when you saw it?
If I'm honest with you, it didn't really provoke in me any very strong thoughts, being brutally honest. I thought the guy was a bit of a dick.
Which he admitted.
Yeah. And I thought that the wife of the man who was initially approached was a bit of a dick.
Yeah.
And I can see why people would be upset with him for the approach that he took and the way that he took it. Because he was quite aggressive. Not aggressive in a bad way, but he was very forceful then in what he was trying to do. Mm. I guess for some people, you know, faith gives them hope. Whether you think that's right or not is a different matter. But for them, faith does give them hope. And that, I think, is quite a valuable commodity for people. You know, almost as much as having cash. So, yeah, I don't... I can see what he was trying to achieve. because I think actually he does make a valid point in so much as, do you know what, I'll give you 20 quid hard and fast here right now if you just cross the word God out from your sign. And that they wouldn't do it. And I could see that from a secular point of view, people would be rolling their eyebrows going, wow, you know, actually, he is making a very valid point. There's 20 quid in your hand purely for crossing a word out. Why don't you just do it? But this comes into the into the realms of belief and faith. And, you know, I guess for those people, actually, it meant more to them to have that than to have $20.
But that's still proving his point, though.
Well, yeah, I'm not saying it doesn't disprove his point. I just think that, you know, with as I've had conversations with you in the past, I think faith and belief are very personal things. Sure. And I don't think, you know, an atheist should be judgmental on somebody because they have a faith. Likewise, I don't think somebody with a faith should be judgmental on somebody who's an atheist. You know, I'm all for, you know, tolerance across the board. And I do just kind of think he was a little bit judgmental in his approach towards his family.
I think he looked at it as some kind of social experiment. I don't think it for him it was anything personal against them. So
no, absolutely not. I mean, you know, I use the word aggressive, and probably the wrong word, because actually, do you know what? He wasn't really slagging these guys off.
He was more having a joke, wasn't he?
Yeah, exactly. Just, and I think, you know, they kind of realised that as well to some extent.
So, but with this Skeptic article, I have to bring her up on something, and you said it. You get it. And I got it, but she said Mike engages them both. Supposed hilarity ensues as he tries to get the couple to give up their faith for $20. Well, he didn't try and do that, did he? He just asked them to cross a word out.
He asked them to cross a word out, but because of their faith,
yeah,
they couldn't do it.
Now, personally, I think there's a problem. Looking at it from the point of view as a social experiment, I think it was flawed because it was filmed and it was on camera, and so. What if you're on camera, you're going to act differently to if you weren't on camera.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that, you know, you don't want to seem to be backing down.
No.
You don't want to be seen to be weak. And so when they see this opportunity, you know, and it's all on film, they want to promote their faith. And so I think that maybe it might have been a different story if the camera hadn't been there.
Potentially, yeah. I could see that.
So that's why I think maybe the experiment's a bit flawed, really. I must say the woman was a dick, though.
Oh, no, I totally agree with you.
Because
I think the guy who was, you know, the guy who was initially with a sign asking for money on the street corner was very passive, but obviously had a faith.
Yeah.
His partner, I'm assuming wife.
No, it was wife, yeah.
Was far more aggressive in her approach. You know, which kind of just fanned the guy who was making the experiments, and Mike was it?
Mike, yeah.
Was sort of fanning his flames then, really.
Yeah. And Mike, you see, Mike wasn't stupid. He knew the reaction he'd get by the video online. So he made it clear. Although he didn't make it clear in the video, he did say straight away, I was going to give him the money anyway. I was just trying to, you know.
Yeah, and you know, let's face it, his name online was, what was the internet
religious antagonist.
So
yeah.
You know, that's he's lived up to exactly what he was doing. You know, he's gone out, he has done exactly what he said he's going to do. I don't really criticize him for it because it was quite interesting. I would hardly say hilarity ensued.
I didn't find it entertaining.
I did find it a little bit cringeworthy. I do kind of think he makes a valid point, but then I do think as well that, you know, he was treating those, and I think this was very unfair, really, when I think about it, he was treating those two people as if they were stupid.
Well, yeah, but I think that might be his argument, in a way. You know, he may consider them stupid, you know, because they're not like him, because they have faith and he doesn't, and he might think that that's a stupid thing to do.
He might think it's a stupid thing to do. I don't think it's right to go and actually, you know, necessarily speak to someone the way he did.
A lot of people were complaining, saying that what he was doing was degrading because they were homeless. But I found that argument was a bit weak. I mean,
I can kind of see that, but I don't agree with it. I can see that, but I don't agree with it.
Yeah, I mean, it's like an architect who's made unemployed may have to go and flip burgers for a living to pay the bills.
Yeah.
He'd find it degrading. There's nothing wrong, though, with burger parlours, though, or burger joints, is there?
No.
So I think that people were just getting very emotional about it because they were homeless and they thought, you know, he was taking advantage of them. But at the end of the day, they could have just said no and walked away.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, there was no need to do it. But this is why the woman, I think the woman was a dick. Because at the end of it, he admits he was a bit of a dick. And, yeah. You know, he was. But he had a deal. He struck a deal with them in the end.
Yeah.
$20. They get to keep the god bit.
They get to keep the god part of the sign. He gets the rest of it.
But then she went and damaged his property.
Yeah.
So I was like, he kind of got a double hit in there. Yeah. Didn't he? So
I totally agree. I did think she was a bit of a dick, and like I said, I thought he was a bit of a dick. Yeah. I did kind of feel sorry for the actual homeless guy stuck in the middle, but between the two of them. But
I,
you know, they got their $20 at the end of the day, which is great for them.
And they got
$20. They didn't have to compromise their belief.
No.
Too much.
But I don't think crossing out a word is compromising belief. Really.
I think it depends. You know, it depends how strongly you believe, isn't it, and what you actually believe.
Well, I thought it was kind of...
And I guess by them crossing out God's name for them, it's symbolic almost of Peter's denial of Jesus, you know?
Yeah, yeah. But that's
why for them it was so difficult to do that.
Mm. And that was the whole point to him. So, and the only thing I wanted to add was, really, we don't really need to go around recording videos of homeless people not accepting money, when there's so many videos of people doing really bad stuff.
Yeah, yeah, I would agree with that as well. Yeah.
There's planes flying into the Twin Towers, for instance.
Yeah.
I don't think you need to go and bother homeless people for examples of the crazy things people do. So I actually left a post saying, you know, I thought it was interesting. I look forward to his future videos, definitely. But I liked it because of the controversy, because it divided everybody.
Provoked debate, isn't it?
But it's strange how it divides people for purely emotional reasons.
Yeah.
Which, you know, I just thought it was quite interesting.
Absolutely.
But there were certain people that were more than willing to take the mick out of homeopaths, like, chakra healers and Gillian McKeith, and really stick the knife in and really mock them.
Yeah.
But then all of a sudden they didn't want to mock this homeless couple, and I was like, he's kind of double standards there. That's the only thing.
Yeah.
So, but yeah, well, you know, I didn't think you were going to go, the guy was a dick and should be thrown in jail. And, you know, I didn't think you were going to go like that. And I knew you'd be a bit more. But there were some people on Skeptic who went absolutely nuts. They really, you know, he was the scum of the earth.
Wow.
So some people do have a heart, or, you know, a bit of compassion.
You saying I don't?
We don't. No.
Okay. I've got another one for you. What's going on in Libya at the moment? Okay, we've got this massive civil uprising, and this week the UK government has been criticised for its slow response in getting British nationals out of the country. So, this has led to today David Cameron making an apology on television, through the media, for the government's handling of the evacuation of British nationals from Libya. This comes a week after he's backed down completely over the sale of forests.
Hmm.
What do we think about this? Is it a good thing that a government is admitting its mistakes and backing down? Is it a bad thing, as a sign of a weak government, that they're not willing to support their own ideas? How do we feel about it?
Well, I think we kind of already discussed this before, haven't we? Because we talked long and hard, I think, about how the concept of a U-turn for a politician. And we both agreed that we think it's absolutely asinine that people have a go at politicians for changing their minds.
Yep.
You know, there's one thing to flip-flop to public opinion all the time, but then there's other occasions where you get presented new evidence, you suddenly realise that you were mistaken, or the evidence you had was wrong, or maybe even that you hadn't realised how serious a problem it was going to be by continuing down that path.
Yeah.
Change your mind.
I mean, you know, John, when you were a child, you did something wrong, what did your parents say to you to do? To apologise?
Yeah.
Yeah?
No, definitely.
And you know what? I'm not a big fan of this government. I'll be brutally honest with you. I thought the plan to sell off the forest was ludicrous, but... yes, through public pressure, they have backed down. And that's not a bad thing. You know, that's actually a good thing, that actually we've got a government which listens to us.
Mm.
You know, we could be like Libya. We could have a totalitarian dictator running the country, skimming off the any money from the country due to his own personal finances, or we could have a government which stands up and say, actually, do you know what, we got that wrong. And we're going to back down on that. And likewise, over getting people out of Libya, yeah, do you know what, I think it's bad that they've been so slow in evacuating our citizens. But actually, you know, they have got the people out of there safely. They have been brought home, finally. And I think it's right that they admit that they were at fault for not having a quicker response.
Yeah, I mean, this government certainly seems to be one that wants to be re-elected rather than... And it's funny now you mentioned this about how, you know, listening to the public. The last Labour government, towards the end, a lot of their policies flew in the face of any public dissent.
Last Labour government, which is why I couldn't vote for them at the last election, they had their fingers in the ears going la 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 la, because they just refused to listen to anybody outside of their own inner sanctum.
Yeah, and what would happen is, and I always use the ID cards as a good example of this, is they wanted to bring it in. People said no. A lot of people who valued their civil liberties said no. They looked at the number of people saying no and said, well, there's not many of them. So but they assume that means that everybody else agrees, and that I think that was the mentality that in the end I hated them perhaps just as much as I hate the Tories.
Well, yeah, and you know, that's the same mentality as the people who still in Wales say that the Welsh Assembly shouldn't be there because only a quarter of the population turned out to vote at the referendum.
Yeah,
and they seem to think that all of those people who didn't turn out to vote were all going to vote no anyway.
Yeah,
You know, they didn't vote, they didn't cast. You can't assume what those people were thinking, and it's exactly the same as that ID card example. You know, you can't assume what people are thinking because they haven't actually vocalised or spoken about it in a public way.
And it just goes to show that you don't need to go to a totalitarian regime like Gaddafi's to find that somebody's in charge doesn't listen to the people, because it happens absolutely in democracies as well. So, and I'm glad this government is actually doing something. They're listening to the people. I mean, obviously, they're not going to be able to listen to people on everything, because they're pushing through some very, very unpopular cuts. But they had, you know, when we voted them in, you know, we voted them in with the knowledge that whoever it was going to have to make cuts. Now, how deep they are is another argument altogether. What do you think about the current cuts?
I would have to agree with, with the opposition on this. I think the cuts are too much, too deep, too soon. I think they go too far, and they could very much undermine the recovery which the government has worked so hard to bring about, which I think is a real shame. I think in this, the government are digging their heels in, wrongly, I think.
But also, I mean, you're really... I don't want to sound... I'm not a financial expert. I'm not an economist, okay? But... should we really be paying that much attention to the party that made so many cock-ups the last time they were in power?
I think the party's changed quite a bit, John, since then. I think you've got complete new leadership right across the board, and I think they've accepted that they made mistakes as a party in government, and they believe that they need to make changes, and they're quite right. You know, John, let's not forget, this is the same Tory party which, you know, 20 years ago had us in recession then as well. You know, there's no immediate answer to financial problems, and I'm not trying to suggest that any one way is necessarily going to be better than the other, but I do think cutting very deeply, very quickly, and I think the government, for instance, are cutting so much from council support that councils are laying people off because they can't afford to keep people on. But there's no jobs for those people, so they're creating unemployment. But they're saying, well, we save money from the councils. You've saved money from the council, but now you're having to pay those people benefits.
No,
that's where they're going too deep, too fast. You know, there isn't jobs coming in to replace those jobs which they're cutting, because they're cutting so quickly. Labour's approach would be to actually, yes, we do need to cut back on this. We do need to get the deficit down, but let's do it more slowly. Let's, you know, try and get jobs in place for people to move into before we actually, you know, end up with a spiraling unemployment problem.
But a lot of people would argue that the only reason why we haven't gone the way of people like Greece and Ireland is that because the austerity measures were deep and quick to allay fears with the credit agencies.
No, I don't think so. I disagree there. I think our economy was always in a much better situation than the Greek economy or the Irish economy. So I don't think there was ever a danger of that happening.
Do you not think there's a major problem with the case of, you know, like Northern Ireland, with such a high proportion of people working in the public sector, and then with Wales as well, not as high, but equally
high? But that's,
you know,
that's exactly
high.
My point. That is exactly my point. There's a high number of people working in the public sector, in councils and in council-related jobs, who are now at risk, and there is no jobs to replace them.
Then
we're creating an unemployment problem.
But, I mean, in the meantime, you know, they've obviously said, well, it's cheaper to pay them benefits, and they cut benefits as well, than to keep them in jobs. And
is it good for the economy to have so many people out of work?
Well, it is if it's saving money.
And therefore being a drain on the economy because they're taking benefits.
No, no, but sure. But whether they're taking benefits or
Is it good for society?
I don't know. That's a separate question.
Well, I think that's a no, isn't it? I think that's clearly a no to have so many people. If we look at social areas with big social problems and social deprivation, they're high unemployment areas. And you see higher crime, you see higher drug abuse, you see higher sort of depression rates, infant mortality rates, obesity rates. And this is all linked to the fact that there's high unemployment in those areas. So socially, high unemployment is not good for us.
No. I mean,
it may save a few coppers in the treasury.
Yeah, but I think that's their argument. Their argument is they're
so desperate.
But then
what about the other costs then associated with those social problems? The cost of extra policing, the cost of extra healthcare?
No, sure. But they're looking at it in terms of balancing the books.
And they're looking short-term. It's short-termism. They need to be looking more long-term. The cuts have to be made. There's no doubt about that. And I think everyone would agree with that. There's absolutely no doubt over that at all. And I've got no issue with having cuts. I think it's absolutely right. We do need to get the economy under control. We do need to cut the deficit. But actually, we need to be cautious about it, because we can't afford to end up with a double dip and to go back into recession as a result of cutting too fast, too deeply.
Well, I think everything's so up in the air. And I sometimes think that economics and things like that is a bit of a guessing game. If we have the double dip, then people are going to be crowing over the Conservatives for the next 30 years. If they don't, then perhaps they're going to see another couple of terms in Parliament.
Yeah, but I mean, potentially. But I think long-term, that's going to create the problems. As we've seen, you know, from Margaret Thatcher's government, closing the mines has seen massive social problems 30 years later in South Wales. And in other mining towns where the mines have closed down, where there is high unemployment, you've got second and third generation unemployment now, and all the social problems go along with it.
No, sure, but
socially, high unemployment is bad for this country, and they need to be aware of that and deal with it. And the Tories have never been aware of social issues in that sense.
Yeah, but when it comes to things like you know, like you're talking about coal mines and talking about industry, you know, we're part of a global economy.
Yeah, sure.
So if the coal mine can't produce
I'm not saying now we should have the coal mines open. That's not what I'm saying, John. I'm saying that
well, 30 years ago
when those coal mines were closed down, this is what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
When those, I'm using them as an example, we have now got social problems. What I'm trying to say is now, 30 years down the line, all these people being laid off from government employment, local authority employment, because they may not get jobs because there's no jobs there for them now, are going to be in exactly the same situation.
No.
I'm not talking about industry people being out of work.
No,
I'm just talking about these people now from these jobs being out of work.
Yeah, I'm talking about the you know, the situation where, for instance, the Labour government were happy to throw money at companies to build factories because you'd hire a lot of people off the back of creating a factory.
Yeah.
But then, you know, as soon as the contract was up and the company could get out of it, it wasn't competitive.
No, you're right. Look, you know, like I said, I don't think there's a quick answer to economics. You know what I mean? My goodness, if I knew that, I'd be a millionaire myself, because I'd have solved the world's global financial problem. There's not a quick solution to it. I'm not saying necessarily that Labour are 100% right. What I'm saying is that I think the Tory-led coalition government is wrong.
Do you think that a lot of our problems are caused by the nature of Western civilization? the fact you got this massive gap between the richest and the poorest.
Yeah, look, absolutely, John, you don't need to get me started on that. You know, there is a massive disparity between the poorest people and the richest people in our society, and that gap needs to be closed and not widened. And it's a fact that under the last government, a Labour government, that gap expanded. That's a fact. There's no doubt. You can't hide behind any figures. The gap between rich and poor got worse, and I think it's going to get worse now with the Tories in power as well. You know, I think we're already seeing that from the point of view. You know, you hear all the rhetoric spouting forth from the government about the welfare dodgers and the people sponging off the state are causing so much problem. The people avoiding paying tax in this country are far more of a problem. The corporations avoiding paying tax in this country is costing the country far more money.
Should I tell you how much it is?
All of the dole blodgers together.
Do you know how much it is? They
please
place,
enlighten us.
They placed the benefit fraud bill at £1.4 billion a year. Do you know how much
didn't Vodafone avoid paying £6 billion last
exactly.
year?
Exactly. The total tax bill has been estimated. It's very hard to quantify. There's all sorts of different. It's a massive.
Yeah.
But it starts somewhere at about £80 billion and goes up to £140 billion.
And what's our national deficit?
I don't even want
isn't it know. Something like 120 billion, something like that?
Yeah, so...
I'm picking that number at the air at the moment. I may be
well,
completely
wrong on
that.
My figures, I remember them pretty...
I'm happy you pulled up on it, but I've got that figure in my head for some reason.
No.
So it may be wrong, but, you know, that's my point, John. That is still the rich continuing their profits on the back of the poor.
Yeah, and for the... But the Tory government gives this... They explain it by saying, well, if we tax them more, then they're going to move. Well, I'm going, well, where will they move?
Where
you're not making any money off them anyway.
Yeah,
so
where are they going to move to?
Countries
have already got higher rates of tax. Germany, France, the corporation tax is much higher.
Yeah. So
what are they going
to
do?
But there's also a problem, but there's a tax loophole that needs to be closed. And I think it's like Nick Clegg's trying to do.
Absolutely, and that's brilliant.
Vince Cable,
it should be closed.
Where money's made abroad... There was this discounting
system. Which is what's happened with Barclays banks, we've mentioned earlier,
yeah.
is that they said, well, they made money abroad, we don't need to pay tax on it.
Hmm.
Ridiculous. Well, absolute nonsense. So
you're meant to pay the difference. So if you made the money in a country where, say, it's 10% tax and it's 20% in this country, you pay the 10% there and you pay that 10% into us. And by doing that alone, and I think this was actually in the Lib Dem manifesto originally, they wanted to close this loophole.
Yeah,
it's out of jail free time.
No, and I totally agree. And, you know, that's what I'm talking about. That's why I voted for Liberals.
Mm.
Yeah, you know, this is the type of thing we need to see. We need to see those tax loopholes closed. And don't get me wrong, you know, the people who are sponging off benefits and are, you know, claiming benefits unfairly, you know, they should have their benefits cut. And yes, we should be looking to claim money back off them. That's quite right. But they're not the be-all and end-all. Let's look at the corporate tax dodgers who are really costing this country money.
Yeah.
And that's my thoughts on it.
You know, I mean, even if, you know, even instead of claiming about the 10%, call it 9% or something, make it competitive. But don't let these companies get away with robbing us of billions and billions.
They say all the companies aren't going to invest in us, or bankers who get paid bonuses, who won't get paid bonuses, are going to leave us and go elsewhere. Well, do you know what? RBS has just made a massive loss again. Hasn't stopped their lead bankers being paid bonuses. I thought bonuses were supposed to be rewarding success.
Well, obviously somebody didn't get the memo.
So, you know, this is ridiculous. This, you know, yes, cuts need to be made. Yes, there's a problem with the finances of the country. So let's get to the nitty gritty. Let's, you know, stop people dodging tax. Let's get the money back in.
So, before we leave politics altogether, because we've talked about terms in Parliament.
Yeah.
The voting system.
Yep.
Now I'm going to be talking to somebody about this.
Yep.
We're going to talk to multiple politicians about this, I think.
Yes,
aren't we?
We are, yeah.
Yeah, so we're going to get a view, and I want to get it done obviously before.
Hopefully, yeah, before
May
the
5th.
Yeah.
So but I've had some interesting discussions with people about AV.
Yeah.
And it's quite obvious that some people have been reading some right-wing newspapers.
The Daily Mail? Not Daily Express?
I think it's probably the Daily Mail, but some of the excuses I've heard is, how is it fair for some people to have multiple votes? You know, it's
clearly people aren't understanding the voting system. Look, we're going to agree on this, I've no doubt, John. AV system is not perfect. AV system isn't really much better than first past the post. But you know what? If we want to see true electoral reform in this country, if we spit in the face of this now, it's not going to happen in our lifetime.
No.
You know, this is the first step in having a transparent and democratic...
More transparent, at
and,
least.
Yeah, it was the first step. As I say, you know, to having a transparent and fair democratic government. And it's absolutely vital that we vote yes for AV.
Yeah.
You know, I fully 100% support it. And we have to vote yes on it.
Yeah, so, I mean, I was hearing a lot of arguments about how AV's unfair and all this, about these multiple votes, and I tried explaining that it's a preference system, and so it isn't, in reality, another vote. What we're doing is we're changing the focus to say we only want to elect people that have 50% of, you know, consensus, in other words. What I did, basically, was I said, right, here's the information, okay, and if you look at them and compare them, for whatever meaning of fair you want to use... AV beats first past the post.
Yeah, of course it does.
So, yeah, as I said, I mean, I don't know, you sounded quite...
I'm just saying that AV I know it's not isn't the answer. It's not perfect.
It's not perfect.
But it's a step in the right direction.
Well, I think it's not perfect, but I think it's...
It's better than what we've got.
It's a lot better than first past the post.
So, okay, and people also say, well, you know, we're going to get more BNP people elected. Okay, I despise the BNP. I think they're scum. However... That's democracy.
Yeah. And first past the post hasn't stopped it. They keep on banging on about how you're going to have hung parliaments. Like, as if we don't have a hung parliament at the moment.
Or we never had a hung parliament in the past. Or this country just functioned perfectly well with hung parliaments. I mean, Belgium hasn't had a parliament for the last 2 years.
Yeah. They seem to do all right.
It's doing all right out of it, you know. So, I think AV, vote yes. We need to have democracy in this country. And that, you know, ties on... I think as well, just ever so loosely, with my blog post the other week about Johan Harry's rant about bishops in the House of Lords. It's not just bishops in the House of Lords we should be concerned about. It's all of the unelected members in the House of Lords. We need to have a fully elected upper house.
Or get rid of it altogether.
Well, I think there needs to be an upper house. You know, in the same way as America's got the Senate and the representatives, we need to have a similar government approach. I think a two-tier government like that is fine, because we need to have the fail-safe of the upper house to ensure that the parliament toes the line. You know, I believe that. But let's have a fully elected upper house.
So how would you have a different... Apart from the fact it's elected, what would you be looking for in people in the upper house?
Gosh, I don't know. I would be looking for them to, you know, hold Parliament accountable. And I think the best example of that I can think of off the top of my head at the moment is in America now, where you've got a House of Representatives, which is one party, and a Senate, which is dominated by another party. And what it's doing is it's keeping each party in check, and there's no real dominant driving force to say, we want this or we want that, which kind of protects people from the nutters.
But there's no reason that's not going to change, and it'll just be Republican both. What happens if it's the Tories?
Yeah,
in
no,
both?
There's a risk of that. Absolutely, there's a risk of it. But yeah, that's what elections are for. If we don't like it, 5 years later, we get to have another vote.
But I don't understand what the point of the second house is if they're both elected.
I think the upper house is a failsafe, isn't it?
Yeah, I know what you're saying,
you don't go on the same day and vote for them. You offset them.
I don't know. I just think, you know, it's too easy to game with political parties, because that's what it'll be dominated by. Instead of Lords.
Yeah, but look.
I'm not arguing for Lords, but
no, because look how they do it now. You know, a party comes into power, they instantly promote members of their own party to the Lords, so they become the dominant force in the Lords. It's ridiculous. It's absolutely crazy. So yeah, let's look at the upper house. I think that needs to be another part of our electoral reform in this country. Is the upper house at the moment? It's just ridiculous.
And I've also been talking to people about the Welsh Assembly and how elections happen there. Mm-hmm. And seems now we're voting to devolve more powers.
Well, no, we're not. I mean, I will be honest. I'll hold my hand up and say I need to do more reading on this because I haven't read enough yet. I just haven't had the time to look into it. But my understanding is at the moment we're not voting for more powers in the sense of we're going to be able to raise taxes and do X, Y, and Z. What we're talking about with the Welsh Assembly election, Welsh Assembly vote, is to actually be able to, for the Assembly to make a decision without having to get it ratified by Westminster, but we'll still only be able to make decisions on the same things that we can make decisions on now.
Well, I'd still class that so as it's a bit more power.
But it's not extra powers in the sense that what the No campaign is a campaign. They're saying, well, this is the next step to independence. This is the next step to cutting away from the UK. It's not what it's about. It's about where Welsh policies have been made in the Welsh Assembly government, which are affecting Welsh people. They're actually going to be enacted without a three-year delay, which I think the example which they use was mental health regulation, which they were trying to pass, which would have improved mental health care in Wales. It took 3 years to go through the House of Commons, yet the Welsh Assembly voted on it. They were all in agreement. That's not fair for the people of Wales to have that type of delay.
No, 3 years is a long time. It's almost the Parliament.
Exactly, in their policy making. So what this vote is about speeding that process up and cutting out the Westminster vote.
Yeah, it's going to be interesting. I mean, for me, it's yes both times.
British government selling arms, doing deals with despotic regimes. What's your thoughts?
Oh, I tell you what, this bugs the hell out of me. I mean, all of a sudden now, these dictators are falling.
Yep.
So what's happening? The government's wanting to seem to be hardline on dictatorships are saying, maybe we could freeze their assets. Maybe we could do this. Maybe we could do that. You know, let's not let them get away. Let's not see Gaddafi flee the country to some lovely, holiday island with all his oil money. Let's take the money off him. I'm thinking, if the guy was that bad before, why didn't you take the money off him then?
Yeah, absolutely. Lord Sugar, who I don't necessarily always agree with, but has actually made a very valid point. It's exactly the same point as what you've just made there now.
Well, I kind of nicked it off him, to be honest. But
that actually, you know, we're talking about freezing Gaddafi's assets. We're talking about freezing Mubarak's assets. They've been dictators for 30, 40 years. What's changed overnight that actually suddenly we're going to say, do you know what? You're a dictator. We're going to freeze your assets. It's a crazy thing. And then, doing arms deals with them. We've provided Bahrain with, anti-crowd resources. What the hell did the government think they were going to use it for?
Yeah, because, it's quite often you need to break into another country and deal with crowds.
and quell crowd violence in another country. Let's be realistic about it, We've profiteered off the back of these regimes for too long, and it's right that actually these countries are getting their own voice. And that may mean that we get an Islamic government in some of these countries. That may be an issue in the future, but these people have a right to democracy. They have a right to freedom from these despots.
I do think it is possibly the most hypocritical thing in the world that you can say to people, we want you to have democracy as long as you pick the government that we want you to have.
Yeah, which is what we've said for years, which is why people like Mubarak particularly have been left in power, because at the end of the day, he was somebody who declared peace with Israel, solved that problem. Wasn't fighting the Israelis, but was just abusing his own people.
Yeah. And all right, even if he's not like doing a Saddam Hussein and gassing them all, if they're still keeping him in poverty and being corrupt,
that's just as bad, as far as I'm concerned. Keeping them in abject poverty while skimming off billions himself, and we're talking billions, is obscene. And it's we should have spoken up a long time ago about this. Our government should never have been standing for it, and certainly shouldn't have been pressurising them.
No, and I tell you what's been interesting as well is that the fear of all of these countries suddenly embracing some kind of, various Islamic republics doesn't look like it's actually going to happen. It seems to be a lot of scaremongering.
I think people are afraid that it may happen as happened in Iran, with the fall of the Shah back in the 70s. But I think, these people have got a real taste of freedom now. And the last thing they want to do is to put themselves back under the yoke of dictatorship. So I'm not sure they would stand for despotic government.
I think maybe what happened to Iran was necessary, because now these countries are going to see the alternative if they embrace conservative Islam.
Yeah.
I mean, they're going to see that Iran itself is struggling to get free of it.
Yeah.
So hopefully, you know, they're not going to follow the same path. I mean, the Muslim Brotherhood, they were very quiet, considering that they were the only people in Egypt who straight away could have formed a government.
Yeah.
But they were very quiet because I think they knew that they couldn't slip in the back door, that the people did want fair and proper elections.
Yeah.
So they've just tried to play the we're nice people card.
Yeah, so I mean, I guess there has to be an element of let's wait and see what happens. You know, let's see how it goes. It may go horribly wrong, but at the moment, let's not jump at shadows, and let's just rejoice in the fact that those people have got some element of freedom in their lives now.
Next story, dude, because I want to wrap this up within 4 minutes.
4 minutes, crikey, okay, well, this is going to be a very quick one then. Story from The Guardian today, gay marriage decision, a blow to the enemies of equality. Discrimination based on sexual orientation has no place in the US. Welcome President Obama to the right side of history. Basically, what we're talking about here is President Obama has declared that the Defense of Marriage Act is unconstitutional and his administration will no longer defend it in federal court. What this means is gay people who get married will have the same rights.
In all states, is it?
In all states as heterosexual people. Or at least they won't be persecuted by the federal government.
Right.
Which I think is brilliant. Well done, Obama. Absolutely the right thing to do. You've got NOM, who's a National Organization for Marriage, who The Guardian describes as a hate group, who've been trying to basically stop this from happening. And the NOM people are saying it's a constitutional outrage. We don't have even... Why do we even have courts if the president himself gets to decide which laws are constitutional? The independent court system in this country is working just as our funders assigned it to do 235 years ago. Yeah, you would say that because it supported you all along up until this point. And actually, do you know what? Somebody needs to stop this happening. So well done, Obama. You've done a great job there.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, I could talk about this quite a bit, actually, because I don't understand. Maybe you may have some insight. I haven't got any insight into how somebody can feel that two gay people getting married somehow affects their marriage or undermines the concept of marriage. I don't...
No idea. I don't get it. I mean, you know, this law has been in place and basically it stopped legally married same-sex couples. So in the states where same-sex marriage is allowed, it has stopped them claiming benefits, it's stopped them claiming certain rights, you know, responsibilities. This is about having equality and level playing field for all. America, many years ago, fought against slavery, you know, fought against discrimination against the blacks, fought for equality, for integration between blacks and whites. This is the same thing, this is the same battle again. This is about fundamental human rights and equality for all people within the one country.
Hmm.
You know, this is a country which is one country under God. You know, you're one country, learn to get together and get on with each other.
Yeah, it shouldn't be one country under God, though. You shouldn't have put that on the...
No, I put that on there because that's what they like to quote. Yeah, that's what I mean. You know, that's what they state, isn't it? You know, one country under God.
It used to be one country indivisible. I prefer that one, really. But especially in terms of, you know, gay marriage and things like that. So it looks like this week the podcast is pretty much 1 hour long. So we're going to go and chill out now. Watch a bit of telly.
Yeah, watch some 10 o'clock live.
And we'll keep you posted on the blog about the future of live podcasting.
Woo!
And interviews with people over Skype. But thanks very much for listening, and we'll catch you next week.
Take care.